Hello and welcome to Patriotic History. Today's date is Friday the 19th of June, 2026, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. This is episode number 76 in our series here, and today I am joined once again by the publisher of armreg.co.uk, that's Germar Rudolph's book publisher, Mr. Jeff Roberts. Jeff, good day, sir. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm fine. How are you, Sven?
Yeah, I'm very, very good. I enjoyed our last episode. I think that went well. I think we worked well together. And I think it's interesting subject matter. And I had some good comments sent to me about it. People were really wanting to, this series to return, basically. Because, as I say, we only got up to William the Norman. And we've got lots of subjects to talk about since then as well. I think we can probably talk a little bit about Oliver Cromwell and Edward Longshanks. Just a couple of characters that I think would be interesting to cover. You got any characters or episodes in history that you think we should do as well?
Simon de Montfort, founder of the English Parliament. He's a fantastic sort of character to look at. And Edward the First, I think you mentioned him. He's an incredibly fascinating sort of character and a brilliant sort of a military strategist. There's quite a lot of sort of people that we might want to talk about later on. But that would be all right to start off with.
Yeah, some good ideas there, I think, Jeff. Certainly some good ideas. Well, let's have a little brief summary of what happened in the last episode. Harald Hardrada, the King of Norway, and Tostig, the brother of Harald Godwinson, have just given battle to Harald Godwinson's men at York by the River Ouse. At first, the English are winning, but when Hardrada arrives, they smash through the English lines and the English earls are forced to retreat to York, where they become besieged. And sort of Northumbria, this sort of area, this is where Tostig was previously the earl, but he did not govern very well, and the people rebelled against him, and his brother Harald Godwinson, the king, had to expel him. Of course, he left for France. And then once Harald Godwinson was crowned king, he then went rebel-rousing and he went to Denmark, tried to get the King of Denmark to come and fight. The King of Denmark wouldn't. So then he went to William of Normandy and said, look, Harald has taken the crown that should rightfully be yours. And William said, yes, I will come and fight. And then he went to Harald Hardrada, the King of Norway, and he said, yes, he wanted to fight. So they've made their way to England. That's the fleet with Tostig and Harald Hardrada, and they made their way to England. First off, they were in Scotland, and then they made their way down, ravaging the country. And now they're basically at York, and they've had this big battle with the English, and now they're besieged, basically. Any comments you want to make, Jeff, about that or about anything that took place in the last episode?
Well, it's quite interesting to read that the battle with the Northern Earls against Tostig and Harald Hardrada, they was actually winning in that battle. For the initial stages, and then Harald Hardrada sort of changed the battle sort of thing by I think it was a flank attack which he did, so they nearly actually won, but now they're actually driven back into York, and I expect they're waiting for a relief from the south. So.
Yeah, I think what happened there, they lined themselves up, and at first the English were winning. And then when Harald Hardrada's men came on the scene, that was when they basically just slaughtered the English. They said there was so much slaughter that, they walked across the marsh on their bodies, effectively, or across the river on their bodies. So perhaps that's an exaggeration, and that's just one report that says it happened when Harald Hardrada arrived. Another report might have given more detail, the one that you've seen there, Jeff, which said it was to do with the battle formation that they had.
I think the other thing is how much cavalry each side had, because if you're an infantry force and you're defeated, then cavalry can outrun most running men. So there would be quite a heavy, very heavy casualties there. I think everybody seems to think that Harald Hardrada would have had mostly infantry, and the cavalry at that time wasn't particularly brilliant, so that the horses were much smaller. And I think the situation is with the Saxons, they used to use them to transport themselves to the battlefield. But I haven't heard much about sort of cavalry at this time used by the Saxons, but I'm sure they had some.
Well, there's also the issue of if you've got horses right by the marsh and the river, you know, they might sink into the mire. So they might not have been too useful to have in if the ground was like that. And yes, we will hear about cavalry later on. And again, we're taking our quotes from the excellent Sharon Turner's History of the Anglo-Saxons, Book 2. And this was written in 1841. And I don't think it's ever been surpassed. It's an excellent history of the Anglo-Saxons. I think there's two books in all. Might even be three. There's lots of appendixes there and lots of references. And it's so well written, it's a joy to read. Well, let's continue then. Harold, watching anxiously the motions of the Duke of Normandy, had stationed his troops on the southern coast. The success of Harald Hardrada compelled him to abandon this position of defence and to march with his army into the north. To repel the King of Norway immediately was essential to his safety, and with this purpose he proceeded towards him so rapidly as to reach York 4 days after the defeat of the English Earl's most concentrated vigour. So it says he's down on the south coast, so all the way up to York in 4 days. I mean, that's pretty good going. That must have been on horses. They must have been galloping. I mean, how long do you think that would? I mean, just to walk that distance would probably take half a year, I would have thought. And that's a long way.
That's very interesting, because there is a new theory that's come out which suggests he actually used his fleet to go up north. And so if he used his fleet, he could get up there quite quickly. The other thing is that using his fleet means that he's basically cut the sort of forces down in the south, and that any sort of attack by the Duke of Normandy would not be successfully defeated by a naval force. So, you know, perhaps that's what we need to ask. Where is the navy at this sort of time? And remember, the horses, as I said, was much smaller, and they used to use them to go into the battlefield, but used to dismount when they actually fought. So, yes, if you've ever ridden on a horse or something, a horse can go a quite long distance, but you can't keep, you know, you have to be careful not to burn them out. You know, they get very tired quite quickly if they're carrying a lot of weight. The other thing is the army can go only as fast as its train. Presumably they needed large amounts of supplies and other sort of carrying other weapons and other sort of things. And they would need to go at a certain speed to keep it all together.
I'm just wondering whether they had stirrups by this time as well. I'm sure I saw something yesterday about stirrups being a massive leap forward in technology with horse riding. And after they had the invention of stirrups, they were able to use the horses for battle as well. Because if you haven't got those, you're just sort of hanging on to the horse. You can't really sort of sit upright and fire a bow or wield an axe around your head. So, I mean, that might have been the reason they didn't have stirrups. That might have been why they didn't use horses so much.
The Romans didn't have stirrups, but they designed the saddle to keep themselves in the saddle. So the saddle made up for the lack of stirrups. I'm not exactly sure when the stirrups came in. I think the stirrups made the Norman cavalry more effective. I think they had them by then. And you could actually spear somebody, or you could use a lance rather than a spear. So that's the difference. But I'm sure they should. Would they show him on the Bayeux tapestry? Might be interesting to have a look and see if it's on there.
Yeah, that would be one way that we could check. I mean, it might have been the Romans that I was reading about. I'm sure I saw something about stirrups and the advent of stirrups. Anyway, continuing with the notes here, Hardrada had been much reinforced by the friends of Tostig and by those adventurers who always join the flag of victory as the time would permit. but the sudden presence of the King of England was an incidence which he did not anticipate. That's interesting there. So he's saying that because the winner was actually Tostig, then you had people moving over to Tostig because they wanted to side with the victorious person. I mean, and he says that this is as time would permit. But I mean, it's pretty much the same today, isn't it? People want to be on the winning team. That's not something that's changed over the years. He had committed his ships to the care of his son Olaf, that's Hardrada, with a part of his forces, and had marched with the rest towards the city to settle the government of the province. The day was beautiful and mild. The sun shone with those pleasing beams which exhilarate the spirits and give new charms to irradiated nature. But alas, the drama of ambition was acting in the country, and its melancholy catastrophe was about to scatter around the dismal spectacle of death. Man was hastening to deform the smiling scene with all the massacres of a ferocious battle. It's so poetic, this prose. It's fantastic.
It's really lovely, isn't it? It's
yeah.
Really nice language.
It's a joy to read. On a sudden, the King of Norway saw an army marching towards him. He inquired of Tostig who they were. Tostig stated his hope that they were a supply of his friends, but he knew enough of his brother's activity also to add that they might be the English forces. The advancing troops were soon discerned to be hostile, and Tostig, wishing a more elaborate preparation, advised a retreat to the ships, that the strength of Norway might join the battle. The King of Norway was hero enough not to decline an offered combat, but he sent three swift couriers to command the immediate presence of his other warriors. So it wasn't just Harold Godwinson that had split his fleet up, basically, as we were saying, probably took half of his fleet with him, or half of his army with him up here in the north. But Harald Hardrada had also only arrived with half of his people. So he sends a courier back to try and get some more. Any comments on this, Jeff?
Well, it's interesting because in the Bayeux Tapestry, there's quite a number of panels which are devoted to the Normans building up a huge fleet. And if they had a huge fleet, and you obviously see a lot of vessels carrying horses and other sort of equipment, then what was the situation with Harald Hardrada? Did he bring a load of horses around to the north? Or what the situation is, I expect what happened was that Tostig had still had quite a lot following in Northumbria, you know, as the losing faction. He, as you said, he was the Earl of Northumbria at the time. And I think one of the things we might see later on is that they make a gesture to him that we give you Northumbria if you commit your forces to the battle. But certainly Hardrada's turned up with a large number of people and he's won a battle, so there must be a lot of people who decide, well, you know, he's going to win, let's join up.
So you can see them just switching sides. Probably had some that were actually inside of York that just left to go out and join Hardrada and Tostig. But at the same time, Tostig was really disliked by a lot of the men in Northumbria, and that's why he was exiled, because he was disliked so much. He really did not govern well when he was the Earl. He drew out his men in a long but not dense line, and bending back the wings, he formed them into a circle everywhere of the same depth, with shield touching shield. In the centre, the royal banner was planted, not unaptly surnamed the Ravager of the Earth. The peculiar mode in which the cavalry attacked was the cause of this arrangement. Then custom was to charge promiscuously in an impetuous mass, to fly off and to return in the same or at some other point. Harald Hardrada was as yet weak in cavalry. It was now but the 25th of September, and he had not had time to mount many of his troops. The King of England, on the contrary, came forth with the strength of the island. And of course, a large part of his army must have been horse. To secure himself against this superiority was the first care of the Norwegian. The first line were ordered to fix their lances obliquely in the ground, with the points inclining towards the enemy, that the cavalry might impale themselves when they charged. The second line held also their spears ready to plunge into the breasts of the horses when near. The archers were joined with the array of Harold and Tostig to contribute their efforts to the success of the day. Were you wanting to make a comment there, Jeff?
Yeah, it's quite interesting, actually, because cavalry are quite effective against archers. Everybody's seen the films about the Battle of Agincourt and that, but the thing was, the cavalry actually reached the archers' lines, but they couldn't penetrate because they had put wooden sticks down with sharpened points, so the cavalry couldn't penetrate. And that's the point here, and this is what's happening here. So that's quite interesting to actually see that they're actually doing this at the time, to stop the cavalry coming in. So amazing. Yeah, it's amazing.
Well, it reminds me of a story we heard a while back when the Britons were fighting against Julius Caesar, and there was a ford or a small river that Caesar's troops would have to cross, and they sunk spikes into it, sharpened spikes. I think it might have even been the Thames where these spikes were put in, because there was evidence of these things still being there many, many years later. I think 150 years ago or something, there's a record of the traces of them still being there. And that was the same technique, basically, putting spikes in, sinking spikes in, so that anybody that tried to cross would get impaled upon them.
Yeah, that sounds very much like the Battle of Aylesford, actually, in Kent. When the Romans arrived, they marched straight across the county, and the river line of the Medway was held by the ancient Britons, and they thought they had blocked up all these sort of fords, and the Romans couldn't get across. They also had a good sort of number of chariots, which they used to use around, and so the chariots would drive you to the battle. The people would jump off, and they would attack. If it was effective, they would carry on with the attack. If it wasn't, they'd get back in the chariots and go and attack somewhere else, just like you're saying here. So, and what they did was, the Romans, they actually got across because they had a number of Batavians in their army, which is Dutch people, and they just swam across and they attacked the chariot cap. So, you know, we've got quite a lot of techniques being used here, which are from history, aren't we? So,
yeah, the fact that the Britons were using chariots as well, before the Romans came, shows that the Britons had roads before the Romans came, because you can't use chariots in the earth or in the fields. You have to have a compacted road in order to have chariots. So it's a myth that all the roads were built by the Romans. They were already here. They were built by the Britons. And also, from the reports that I've seen, it said that chariot warfare had fallen out of use pretty much everywhere else in Europe. But that was what they used in Troy. And that was the Trojan form of warfare. And that was the reason why they were still using it in Britain, was because of this heritage that goes back to Trojan times. And of course, that was in the previous author that we were using, that did a very good history of the Britons, of the Welsh, basically. And what we're doing now is we're looking at the history from the viewpoint of the Saxons. Hardrada rode around in his circle to inspect its order, his horse stumbling. He was thrown to the ground, but he sprang up and wisely exclaimed that it was an omen of good. Harold, who observed the incident, thought otherwise. He inquired who that Norwegian was, clothed in a blue tunic and with a splendid helmet, who had fallen. He was answered, the King of Norway. "He is a large and majestic person," replied Harold, "but his fortune will be disastrous." Again, I'll just pause there, because, I mean, today you would have people in camouflage, and you certainly wouldn't put an important person all dressed up in a royal tunic that could be picked out that was the king. But these were in different times, and you know, you had your honour to think of, and the king would lead the army, and he would look splendid, and you would be able to tell who he was, And that, that, I guess that was also a manner of showing off. You know, I can afford to show you all who I am because my troops are so good. My bodyguard, my troops are so excellent.
The other thing is that a lot of it is pride, isn't it? So you look at Nelson at the Battle of Trafalgar. They said to him to cover up all his medals, and he just refused. You know, so if he's if it seemed like he was taking cover or hiding behind other people, not exactly as hiding behind people, but being the same as everybody else, it would diminish his command factor, wouldn't it? Wouldn't you think so?
Well, yeah, that's the point. So they would take these risks because it showed what a great team of bodyguards that they had around them. It was a way of also intimidating your foe, I should imagine. I mean, also, when you think of it, I mean, the Britons, we used to have the redcoats, didn't we? I mean, we didn't used to wear camouflage. Even, like, as well, if you were a soldier, you would wear clothing that marked you out as a soldier because you wanted to only fight against other soldiers. You certainly didn't want to fight against the civilians or the peasants. And that was the reason for it. And you think about today where they, you know, so many civilians end up getting hit in the warfare that we have today. Years ago, that would not happen. I mean, that was dishonourable. You would only go for somebody who was wearing the regalia of the army, not somebody who was in camouflage. And if somebody was captured and they were a noble, then they would be treated with respect. They would be given the respect that that role that they had within the army deserved. So if you had like a general or a captain, they would be treated with great respect. Whereas since World War II, people that are the leaders of the army or the leader of a country or the sovereign of a country, we end up putting them to death. We end up putting all the National Socialists to death at the end of the war. Look at Muammar Gaddafi, who I think it was General Gaddafi, something like that. I mean, he was the leader. He was sodomized to death. And look what they say about leaders of Serbia when they were basically ended up having to kill himself while he was in court. I mean, these people are not, we no longer treat our enemies with the respect that they used to command in history.
Well, that's absolutely right. So then the situation here is that look at Saddam Hussein. They overthrew his regime. They eventually captured him, and then they got somebody to hang him. Now, you would think to yourself, what happened if there had been a miraculous sort of turnabout of fate here? You know, would that person, who I can't remember his name, but he was the American commissioner, would he then be regarded as a war criminal? You know, so it only seems people are war criminals if they lose. The victors are never seen to be judged. I think the other interesting thing here is that from his distance, it says Harold did observe the incident. He said the Norwegian was clothed in a blue tunic. Now, blue is a very amazing colour because it only comes from a cave in Afghanistan. And you see Renaissance paintings with blue, and it was very expensive to get this. So if somebody's got a blue tunic on, they're going to stand out, and it's probably very expensive. And it must have been quite close, mustn't they? They must have been within sort of several hundred yards to actually see this person was. But having a blue tunic, that's going to make you stand out, isn't it?
I don't think they had binoculars either. And just mentioning blue there, I think purple was also rare, wasn't it?
I think that's right. Purple was only be allowed to be worn by emperors, and it stunk, apparently. And I think it was made from sort of the crushed sea sort of creatures or something, sea snails or whatever. So it was really, very odd. But they had very sort of strict clothing sort of regulations in certain times of history when you couldn't wear anything. You know, look, just imagine it's like turning up and the king's there and you've got better stuff than he's got. You know, they wouldn't like that at all, would they? And it also says he's quite a large and majestic person as well. So perhaps he is a very tall man, Harald Hardrada.
Well, you'd imagine that royalty would reach the extent of their phenotype because they would be fed so well. the peasants probably weren't nourished so well, so they were probably still quite small, whereas royalty and nobles, I should imagine, were very tall. I mean, we have records of lots of kings in history being very tall. Edward Longshanks, for one. And also, just when you're referring there to the textiles and the clothes that they wore, the only sort of historical evidence we really have most of the time of what these people wore was in paintings, because textiles don't get preserved very well. They're the first things that rot away is somebody's clothes when you find their body, which is why it was such an amazing find in the salt flats of the Tarim Basin when they found the earliest evidence of Caucasians who were there before the Mongols. And their clothing was still preserved, and they had trousers on and a tunic and a felt hat. I mean, it could have been clothing that people were wearing today, and yet I think it was from something like 3000 BC or 2500 BC. And the reason why it was preserved was because of the salt. So I think that's one of the earliest records we have of clothing, because, as I say, it's the first thing that goes.
Yeah, that's a very interesting point. You're talking about the ancient Tartarians. They seem to be Celtic, the way they sort of dressed and everything. And as you say, it's amazing that all their clothing survived. It was dug up by the Chinese authorities, and there's a great deal of debate about it because they didn't think Caucasians had got that far sort of east. But there's, you know, there's no reason to doubt this now. But the other thing is that why they were fortunate in being preserved, if you look at the Anglo-Saxon kings in Essex and other places, all their sort of bodily sort of remains actually disappeared. So they can't tell who they are, and they don't know what happened to them, which is a lot strange, isn't it? It all depends on the various conditions. Similarly, I suppose, like you look at the Roman tablets up in, they were found in that fort, which they've been thrown on a rubbish tip. And they actually found them, and then they found out that Romans are actually writing to each other, which they never thought used to happen. So, yeah, it's a question, isn't it? It's a question of luck, really, or of just what the temperature is and weather, climate, and so forth.
Well, you mentioned the Anglo-Saxon kings there, and I think they didn't find the clothes. Obviously, the remains of the bodies would have rotted away, but that the helmets were still there, weren't they? And the jewellery and everything that was made of metal was still there. And I think we did do an episode, I'm not quite sure which number it was, and it was on the postal system. I can remember talking about the postal system, and even going back to Sumeria, Mesopotamia, they had tablets, clay tablets that they would write in. And these clay tablets would get taken by horseback from one end of the realm to the other. So I would imagine the same happened in Rome. They would have had a postal system. And it's amazing to think about, going back thousands of years, and you, if you were a noble, you would be able to get a message from one end of the country to the other in a matter of days. I mean, pretty similar to today, when we can post letters from the south of England and they'll get to Scotland in a couple of days. I mean, maybe in years gone by, it might have taken a bit longer, might have taken a week to get there, but it would still get there. That system was still there, and they would use they'd have horses along the way. They'd have like way stations with the fresh horses waiting, and the courier would ride up there as fast as he could on his horse, drop the horse off, grab another one, and ride again in order to get these messages across as quickly as possible. So I'm not sure the Romans must have had a postal system if the Sumerians
did. They certainly did. You know, and there was actually, in ancient Greece, they had a sort of system like that, but they used to have runners because the ground wasn't really suitable for horses. And there is a famous sort of story of Philopoetes, who ran to Marathon, took part in the battle, and ran back to Athens to say they had won. So they had runners. The other thing is that with horses, you know, you've got something called a stagecoach. And most people don't think about this. It's a stagecoach because it goes in stages. It goes to a certain point, the horses are changed, and then it carries on. So, you know, it gets you there, doesn't it?
Well, you mentioned runners, and that was the first job. Well, that was the job Adolf Hitler had during First World War. That's why he was given his medal, his awards. He had the most dangerous job that there was, which was taking the mail to the ones at the front in the trenches. So he'd literally have a mailbag by his side, and he'd have to go up over the top, run along the top there, running the risk of being shot at, and drop down into the next trench and drop all the letters off to from their beloved ones back home. Incredible bravery there, and he volunteered for that job as well. So, you know, doing the same thing as what you were saying there with the Greeks, but also under fire at the time as well. Do you know if you've got a comment on that, Jeff?
Yeah, well, it's very interesting actually, because Adolf Hitler only wore his Iron Cross, which he got, and he got that in combat. But Stalin had a ton of chess floor medals, but he was never in action, never. So it's just amazing. It's just a question of, like, well, people sort of taking on sort of things which they don't deserve. And Stalin was very much like that. Now, you take Hermann Göring. Now, he was a fighter ace in the First World War. I think he shot down 30 or 40 enemy planes. That's just like having somebody, a war hero, leading the country. So it is amazing, isn't it? Isn't it really amazing how you've got somebody who's very brave and in military action, and then you've got somebody like Stalin who isn't, but's got so more medals. And I think Mussolini was the same. Mussolini was a very brave soldier. So I'm reminded of Winston Churchill. You know, he went to the front, but he actually never went as far to the front or close to the front. And he ended up at Battalion HQ, where that was the only place where you could drink alcohol, which is strange, really. You know, you'd think they allow you to drink alcohol at the front, but obviously didn't. And you couldn't drink it at the corps headquarters. But Battalion HQ, that's fine.
That's interesting. We don't have military men leading us anymore, men that have shown their bravery under duress. You know, we have lawyers basically ruling us now, don't we?
Yeah.
They're all lawyers, human rights lawyers and the rest of it.
That's very true. And it's a real turn up of events, isn't it? You know, because you used to have people running the country and they would be expected to lead their men into battle. You know, earls and dukes and people like that. And, you know, Duke of Wellington is a good sort of point, isn't he? You know, being in battle, cannibals running, rolling about all over the place and sort of shooting through the air and everything. But we haven't had that. I can't think of the last sort of prime minister we had who was actually in the armed forces. Can you?
Well, it's probably Winston Churchill. As you say, I mean, he didn't lead at the front. He really didn't do very much. But I think he was involved in the armed forces in the late 1800s, I think it was.
Yeah, well, most people don't remember that he was actually only in the army for a very little time. He was at the Battle of Alderman, and he was in one of the last charges that British cavalry were in. But the enemy had already broken, and the madman in his forces, there had been virtually, his army had been smashed. And they were saying like 35,000 casualties, huge amount. You know, there was going up against machine guns, Gatling guns, a cannon, a musketry and everything like that. And so there was large numbers of them killed. The enemy was running away and they had a cavalry attack. But after that, he became a correspondent. So when he went to South Africa, he wasn't in the army. He was a correspondent. And knowing that and doing that was a way to get ahead, because he could write sort of things about his own exploits, and they'd be passed on to his mother. And his mother had a load of friends in the press, and he was built up to be a hero. So, for example, his escape from the Boers, he didn't really escape from the Boers. He had been interned as a civilian, and he just walked out the camp. And incredibly, he sort of managed to get to Mozambique on a train, which sounds really strange. It sounds really a bit odd, that really.
Yeah, I guess that would have been promoted as Winston Churchill's daring escape from the Boers. I'm sure we covered that as well in Churchill's Body Count, another earlier series that we did here at Radio Albion. Getting back to Sharon Turner here and the battle. An offer was sent to Tostig before the battle joined to give him Northumbria and other honours if he would withdraw from the impending conflict. Tostig remarked that such a proposition in the preceding winter would have saved many lives. But, added he, if I should accept these terms, What is to be the compensation of the king, my ally? 7 feet of ground, or as he is a very tall man, perhaps a little more, was the answer. This intimation closed the negotiation, for Tostig was faithful to his friend. So that shows you that he was loyal, even though he wasn't a very good earl. At least he was loyal to this other king. But he wasn't loyal to his brother, who was Harold Godwinson. I mean, don't forget, this was two brothers that were fighting here. And quite clearly, Harold Hardrada must have been very tall then, if he's saying that 7 feet of ground over the top of him, or as he is a very tall man, perhaps a little more. That sort of implies that he must have been about 6 foot tall, I would have thought. Any thoughts on this, Jeff?
Yeah, I think so. What you were saying earlier, Sven, was that the ruling classes, they always have the best food. They're eating most meat most of the time. They're eating the best cuts of meat. While ordinary people, you know, they weren't eating the same sort of diet. So it must have been a genetic effect over sort of over time to have actually better and healthier sort of people. The other thing is that you mentioned Winston Churchill. Winston Churchill used to eat bacon dripping sandwiches, and you saw him in that incredibly fatty sort of diet. And during the war, Second World War, he had sort of times when he collapsed, and he always had his doctor next to him. So these people probably had the best doctors as well. So I expect that was the situation with Tostig and sort of Harald Hardrada, that they were the ruling sort of elite of the country. They probably did have actually what you said, you know, a better sort of diet, better health.
I think that lasted, I think, right up until about 150 years ago. And if you look at houses from 150 years ago, the doorways are much lower. In fact, when I was in prison in HMP Swansea, I had to duck down to walk through the doorways. So that shows you that the people at the bottom of society were much shorter than they are today. And that was because they didn't have the nutrition that we have today, or they didn't know enough about nutrition. I mean, we know more about it now. I mean, back then, we didn't even know how to avoid scurvy on a long ship journey. You needed vitamin C. We didn't know anything about these vitamins and nutrients that we understand now. Getting back to the notes here. The Norwegians, not having expected a battle on that day, are said to have been without their coats of mail. The King of Norway sung some stanzas on the circumstance and awaited the attack. And again, I'll just pause there. I'll keep pausing in places, but it's so interesting. The fact that the king would sing some songs to his troops to raise their spirits because they didn't have coats of mail. You know, and the bardic tradition was so important at that time, and that was all done in song, and it was all done in rhyme. Would he have made these up off the top of his head? I mean, or would he have sung some stanzas which he had memorized? But it just shows you the difference today. I mean, you wouldn't have the kings singing some songs to rouse the troops, or perhaps you would have the troops doing that to raise their morale. But not necessarily the king, and to think that that's to compensate them for not actually having any coats of mail with them, not having coats of mail put them at a great disadvantage, I would have thought. Any thoughts on the king singing songs in these circumstances, Jeff?
Well, I would think so, yeah, because all eyes would have been on him and he would have been expected to say something, because not having your coats of mail with you is quite an exceptional sort of thing, isn't it? If you're hit with an axe and you haven't got a mail coat on, then that's going to do damage. If you've got your mail coat on, it won't do as much. So, well, I expect the king probably knew lots of sort of songs, you know, like you said about the bards and the people like that, and poets. You know, that's how they sort of spoke to people, didn't they? And it was well known that the amount of sort of literature at this time was still quite a lot, quite considerable. Yeah, so I think so. Yeah, that sounds quite a thing. But what is interesting here, why are they without their coats of mail? Have they not been brought up? Or are they still on ship or what? Did that mean they fought the first battle without their coats of mail? You know, or perhaps they didn't arrive or something? I don't know.
Perhaps it meant they could have got there quicker on horseback, perhaps, without the weight carrying that weight with them, do you think?
A possibility of that, really. But I would have thought what happened was that if they're rowing across the North Sea or they're coming down on, you know, and according to the wind direction, if you can sort of put up your sail, then it's easier, a lot easier. But a lot of the time it's the wind direction, which is important. And in England, the wind direction is northeasterly and southwesterly, and most airfields are in that direction. So I suppose what happened was that they went down on the ship, and they had a lot of equipment on supply ships, but they didn't have as many as the Normans did. And I think we'll see that later on. I think that's an important point from the Bay of Tapestry, that they actually built huge numbers of ships to take their horses and all the rest of their supplies.
Yeah, massive numbers. We went into that a few episodes back. His orders were implicitly obeyed. The charges of the English cavalry were received on their implanted points, and while the Norwegians kept their circle unbroken, they repulsed every attack. Weary of their unprevailing efforts, the English began to relax in some confusion, and their adversaries were tempted to pursue. It was then that the fortune of Norway first drooped. The English returned to the charge. The Norwegians were out of their defensive arrangement and felt the destructive fury of the English weapons. Hardrada encouraged his men by the most heroic exertions, but he could not bind victory to his standard. A fatal dart pierced his throat, and his fall gave the first triumph to his kingly competitor. And I'll just stop there, because I think the Saxons were using axes. So, of course, if you're going up against an axe without mail, I mean, it's could very well be fatal. But this shows that they also had archers. And I don't think they had longbows at this point. And I think we'll see later on with William that he had crossbows. So it must have been some kind of bow and arrow that they had, for them to say that a fatal dart pierced his throat. Any thoughts on that, Jeff, or the weapons that were used?
Well, they had archers, but they was using a short bow. They wasn't using a long bow, and I think the Bay of Tapestry shows that. They also had slingers as well, which were also taking part at this time, and they're also depicted on the Bay of Tapestry. But what I find quite interesting, what you were saying there, is like they kept their circle unbroken. So presumably the English cavalry had surrounded them, and they was formed into a circle, or what, you know, an infantry square like at Waterloo or so, but a circle. And they defeated the English again and again. And when the English started running away, they thought, well, they won. They just chase after them. And that sort of opened them up, because a cavalry can rally really quite quickly. If you're on a horseback, you know, it doesn't take very long to get back to where you was. So I think this might have been a quite a strange sort of thing, really, because we probably see if this happens with the Normans at sort of Hastings later.
So this was the undoing of them, basically, was chasing after the English. The English were on
That's
horseback.
Right, yeah.
The English could turn around and get into them then, because they were no longer this sort of defensive unit in the middle. Tostig assumed the command, and the battle still raged. Harald again offered life and peace to his brother and the Norwegians, but the enraged Tostig was deaf to reconciliation. Again, I'll have to pause there, because, I mean, this shows that in the middle of the battle, they were able to have a pause, and they were able to make these offers of peace to the other side. Now, I know when we were talking about the earlier Britons, and when they were fighting against the Romans, there were rules of war that civilized nations observed. And it meant that at a certain time you stopped fighting, and also on certain days. I mean, you wouldn't be fighting on a church day, for instance. You wouldn't be fighting on a Sunday. You would be receiving mass. So this shows that they were still observing these rules of warfare. And I guess they must have after a certain amount of time, or when the sun is at a certain part of the sky, then you have to pause. Or they might have had a signal used by a flag or something like that, that meant, well, we need to have a pause and we can have a parley and we can make an offer. So again, this shows you that they were still civilized. In the middle of this battle with axes and arrows and slings and all the rest of it, they were still able to call a halt to proceedings and have another attempt at diplomacy before re-engaging. Any thoughts on that, Jeff?
Yeah, well, that's quite interesting you said that, because Tostig here has obviously got the command. The battle's still going on, and it may have been in Harald's interest to try and end the battle there and make a sort of declaration of that to his brother. But it seems like he must have known that the division from the ships, the troops that were looking after the ships, were on their way. So perhaps that's what he was expecting. You know, perhaps he was expecting sort of these troops to, help out.
So he's expecting reinforcements. I mean, that was one of the reasons. Again, it shows you that he's loyal as well, because the person he's allied with is, he knows he's now died, so he's no longer fighting to put that king on the throne, and yet he continues to battle, basically, I guess, because it would have been an insult to his honour if he didn't. Victory or death was his decision. And the arrival of the division from the ships under the command of Eystein Orr gave new hopes to his fury. These fresh troops were completely armed. Their attack was so vehement that the fortune of the day was nearly changed. But they were exhausted by the speed with which they had hurried to the place of conflict. Their exertions relaxed as their strength ebbed, and after a desperate struggle, Tostig and the Flower of Norway perished. Harald, who had shown himself the ardent warrior throughout all the combat, permitted Olav, the son of the unfortunate Hardrada, and Paul, the Earl of the Orkneys, to retire from the island with their surviving friends and a few ships. Olaf went to the Orkneys and in the following spring to Norway, where he reigned jointly with his brother Magnus. And again, that shows you how civilized they were. And these people have been fighting against them, and they just permitted them to go back. They didn't take them prisoner and hold a kangaroo court and hang them all. They did the civilized thing, and they allowed them to go back, even though they'd been fighting against them. I mean, this is the way that battles used to be fought, when men were still honourable, unlike post-Second World War. Any thoughts on that, Jeff?
Yeah, I think that's a very true situation, that there is a point in human history. I think that's the American War of Independence, when people still fought against enemy troops rather than civilians. But I think it really goes downhill when you get the American Civil War, and the first concentration camps were set up by the Unionist forces in Missouri. So you then got the situation where the march across Georgia, which was designed to do as much damage as possible. You know, it was designed to stop people eating. It was destroying all the food stocks and everything. So you're going from a war being carried on in a sort of gentlemanly sort of manner to a war that's being carried on to a complete, utter sort of destruction of the enemy. I think that's very true. You know, you look at the Second World War, you know, it's Winston Churchill who started a bombing campaign against Germany, and it's well known that Hitler stopped any attacks on London for some time before actually taking reprisals against Britain. The other thing was that when this happened, the bombing raid, which Churchill cited as an excuse, was actually in Croydon, which is a long way away from London, as everybody knows.
I think also when Hitler had the English at Dunkirk, and he allowed the English to send their boats over to take them all back. And at that point, Britain was defeated, and the British army was at Hitler's mercy. And traditionally, if you're in a situation like that, you either accept death or you accept slavery. You have lost the battle. And that was it. And I think Hitler expected Churchill to stop the war at that point, because his army was at the mercy of Hitler. And instead of killing them all or enslaving them all, which is what would have happened in the past, he allowed them to go back. He did the gentlemanly thing. I think that was one of the last civilized actions that really happened with the white man, effectively, was at that point. And then after that, it was just completely uncivilized. As I say, when they captured the Germans, they had a kangaroo court and they hanged them all instead of allowing them to go back to where they were and continue as aristocratics, as happened here when they let Olaf go back and work with Magnus, the king of Norway, rather than executing him.
Yeah, that's right. There is a situation there with no prisoners, isn't it? And it was shocking to see that the United States has got a long history of attacking other sort of countries. And they talk about the Iran war. What they should be talking about is the Israeli and American attack on Iran. But so it always seems like Iran is the troublemaker. And the first thing that happened was, despite the precision-guided weapons they got, they hit a school. So, I don't know, there was, 150 sort of pupils were killed? It's amazing. It is amazing how society is getting more and more sort of dangerous, more and more lethal to ordinary people.
Becoming more and more savage. I mean, I know we're taught like, oh, well, we had the Stone Age, then the Bronze Age, then the Iron Age. Now we're in the technological age. I don't see it like that. I see it in the old way, that we had a Golden Age, a Silver Age, a Bronze Age, and now we're living in the Age of Mud. The same as the prophecy from the Old Testament that shows you the statue, and it's gold at the top, silver, bronze, and at the bottom it's iron mingled with mud. And that's effectively the different world empires. So I think we started off as near to perfect as could possibly be. And then we've gradually lost our morals, lost our intelligence, lost everything, basically. And going back to this time here with the king, that he could recite these stanzas, he could remember them off by heart. You know, the scribes, when they translated the Old Testament for Alexander the Great, they remembered all of those books off by heart. They were just set in these little huts on their own with the all the scribal stuff that they needed to write it. And it was written from memory. And you look today, people can't even remember their phone number. do you know what
yeah,
I mean?
That's very true. The situation was, if you look at the Greek national anthem, it's got about 30 verses, and people used to know all that. And in Islamic countries, people get prizes for memorizing the Quran. You know, now I don't know if most people actually even look at a Bible nowadays, but as you said, the memory is gone. The situation about racial memory or anything has actually disappeared. And I think that's the basis for the book 1984, when Orwell says people can't remember anything. You know, they can't remember what things were like in the old times, apart from the fact it was the upper class wore top hats. So that's about it. So they just can't remember anything. And I think this is a situation that happens quite a lot, is that people don't know anything about anything anymore. You know, it's not repeated, it's not shown. And the Bayeux Tapestry must have been a marvellous sort of thing, because you can actually walk along it and point out what's going on. And bear in mind, a lot of people couldn't read or write. But you still had people like in the churches, what are they called now, the person who's a servant of the clergyman. I can't remember, it's off the tip of my tongue.
Is it a clerk or a deacon?
Well, that's the sort of thing I'm looking at, yeah. But they used to have people, and they couldn't read or write, and they just remembered everything. But you know, it was all done by memory.
Yeah, I say, you could say, well, that was the people at the top of society. The people at the bottom of society, you know, they wouldn't have remembered these things. But it still meant that you had a class of people that had such a perfect memory that they could recall all of these classics that were literally just put to memory, and we're not able to do that anymore. So I think we've gone from a very high point, the highest point, where we were the fittest, we had great immune systems, everything was eugenic, because it was entirely natural. If anybody was weak, they wouldn't make it to adulthood, they wouldn't be able to reproduce. So you had the strongest, the fittest, the most mentally fit white men that have ever lived. And we've gone through that now to the stage where we're at now, where unfit people make it into adulthood and breed because of the technological and medical advancements that we've had, to the stage where 90% of the people that are around today would never have made it to adulthood 150 years ago because of the conditions that we had.
Well, that's very true, Sir Ed, but the situation is that people are not even having children nowadays, are they? My son sent me a copy of this article about South Korea, and South Korea could disappear within a generation. It's that fast. No European country is producing over 2.1 children, which is necessary for survival. And what is surprising, you would think Italy, they have a lot of children there because they're a Catholic country, but no, it's still low there. And there's so many factors that are taking place. There was a programme on Al Jazeera the other day, and they was talking about Nigeria, and the expansion of Nigeria is enormous. It's absolutely amazing how fast it's increasing. And they said that at one time, I think it was 1900, the Europeans made up 30% of the world, and now they make up about 8%. And it's decreasing all the time. This ratio is going down like anything. So, as you said, you know, perhaps certain people wouldn't survive then, but we're not even replacing ourselves.
Well, I think also, if you look at places like Nigeria, it's a completely unnatural growth explosion because it's unsustainable. The only thing that sustains it is Western technology, Western medicine, Western vaccines. It's the West's technology that has allowed that to happen. I think if you go back 80 years ago or whatever, 30% of the world's population was white. I think if you were to go back 500 years ago, you'd find that something like 50 or 60% of the population was white. And if you go back even earlier, you ended at a time where about 90% of the population were. And I think the reason why it's now the complete opposite way around is because we made all these advances in medicine and technology. And, you know, we're generous people, we're charitable people. We shared these technologies, we shared these advancements and civilization with these other groups of people that had never actually had civilizations of their own. And the result is that they have a completely unsustained growth explosion. And the people that came up with this technology in the first place are not producing enough to replace ourselves. I mean, that they're still reproducing at a rate of sort of 8 children to one mother in parts of Africa, and it's still increasing in the multicultural countries as well. It's mainly Europeans that are decreasing, and also Japanese. They've got a fertility problem. And as you were just saying there, the Koreans. So there is an idea that it's modernity that causes this. But the end result is you end up with more and more people that are less able to maintain a civilization. And I think go back millennia, and you had white people that did build civilizations, and they were the majority because the other groups of people could only survive by sort of foraging. They didn't farm, they didn't have writing, they didn't have a wheel, they didn't have all of these technologies. They were just essentially living in the wild. So I don't see how there could have been very many of them that survived, to be honest. Any thoughts on that, Jeff, or any thoughts on the podcast today? I'm thinking we should probably leave it there and continue in the next episode.
Well, I think the situation is that you look at the world population. I think it's about 8 billion, and China and India are two countries who make up 2 billion. Each got 1 billion each. You know, it's huge numbers. And yet it doesn't seem like our governments or the governments in Europe are doing anything about it. They just seem to be drifting along. You know, they do something about it eventually. But as you can see, the amount of migration that is going to go to Europe, you know, is a bit like Camp of the Saints, this novel I wrote, I read some time ago. And it's going to be a huge, huge sort of migration effect. And this was happening in the United States. You know, large numbers of people coming from South America, human trains of people trying to get into the US. So that's going to be a very difficult situation to sort out. Because the other thing is they're going to say, well, we ain't got enough workers and we need to get some more workers in. So
Well, you've got AI now. You've got AI now, haven't they? I mean, they've imported all of these people, and now we've got technology that will replace a lot of the lower skilled jobs. They can have AI managing everything. So what are they going to do then? I mean, they understand that because of the fertility rate, the population is going down. But instead of doing what places like Hungary and Poland were doing by encouraging the Hungarians and the Poles to remarry and stay married and reproduce and have more children, instead in the West, we just import people from Africa to replace them, as if they're possibly going to be able to maintain our civilization for us when we become a minority. And the lesson of history is that that's not going to be possible, which is one of the reasons why we do these podcasts, so that we remember true history and we talk about it and we talk about our heritage, which is really what this is all about. Well, Jeff, thank you very much for coming on today. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back in 2 weeks' time with more patriotic history for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.